Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We're here to give you the clearest possible shortcut to, well, really understanding the big topics. Today, we are diving into something that affects almost everyone, retirement security. It's a universe of, you know, acronyms, jargon, complex math. It honestly feels like it's designed to be confusing. So our mission for this deep dive, using the great source material you send over, is to just cut right through all of that noise. We want to give you a really clear map of the two foundational types of retirement plans. We're talking defined benefit, or DB plans, the classic pensions you think of from your parents' generation, and then defined contribution, or DC plans, which are, you know, pretty much the global standard now. They represent totally different contracts, really. Okay, let's unpack this.
I think that's the perfect way to frame it. The whole thing, this entire deep dive, it really boils down to one simple question. What exactly is the employer promising to define? Is the guarantee about the benefit you'll get years from now?
Or is it just about the contribution they'll make today?
Precisely. In a defined benefit, or DB plan, the employer guarantees a specific payment. It could be a monthly check for life, a lump sum, whatever. But that final amount, it's predetermined by a formula. You know what you're getting. But in a defined contribution, a DC plan, it's the formula for the contribution that's known. You know, what you and your employer are putting in. But the final benefit, that's totally up in the air. It depends entirely on how your investments do. You won't know the real number until the day you retire.
So it's the difference between a contract that says, we promise you'll get $5,000 a month when you're 65, versus one that says, we promise to put $5,000 in an account for you every year, but good luck.
That's a great way to put it.
It seems like a simple trade-off, but I imagine the consequences for who holds the risk for liability are just massive.
Yeah. They're enormous. And U.S. law, especially the Internal Revenue Code, draws a really sharp line between them. A DC plan is basically any plan with individual accounts where your benefit is solely based on what's in that account, the contributions plus any earnings. A DB plan, it's simply defined as any qualified pension plan that isn't that. The structure itself dictates who is responsible for what.
All right, let's start with that older model then, the one that sells the promise of certainty, the defined benefit plan. Historically, these were the gold standard for governments, public sector jobs, and, you know, those huge industrial companies that really dominated the middle of the 20th century. Our sources even say that these pensions were sometimes used as a form of deferred pay. Like, instead of a bigger paycheck today, you get this promise of security tomorrow.
Yeah, and that context is so important, because if it's a promise of deferred pay, the employer has to be the one to carry that liability. They manage the fund, they make the investment choices, and this is the critical part, they bear all the investment risk. If the market tanks or interest rates fall off a cliff, it's the employer's job to step in and make up the difference.
So the employee gets that certainty, but the company gets all the volatility. Okay, but here's the part I think most people don't get. What happens on the flip side? If the investments do amazingly well, who gets that extra money?
That surplus. It goes right back to the employer, the plan sponsor. And when you think about it, that makes perfect sense structurally. Since they're legally required to cover any and all deficits to pay you that promised benefit no matter what, they also get to keep any of the upside. For the employee, the target is always just that preset benefit. It doesn't matter if the fund is at 80% of its goal or 120%.
Wow. That sounds incredibly risky for a company, especially today. I mean, how do they even start to calculate how much they need to put in each year?
That is the million-dollar question, and it's the job of an actuary. This is why the employer's contributions are so uncertain. They aren't fixed. They are, as the jargon goes, actuarially determined. And this process is basically corporate fortune-telling. The actuary has to project all these highly uncertain variables, you know, decades into the future. They have to estimate life expectancy for the whole employee group, project future interest rates, guess at employee turnover, and then, based on the specific benefit formula, calculate how much cash the sponsor needs to put in today to make good on that promise 30 or 40 years from now.
So if the actuary suddenly revises their projections, like people are living 3 years longer, or they expect lower interest rates for the next decade, the company's required contribution for that year could just skyrocket.
It could, and it often did. I mean, that uncertainty is exactly what created the huge balance sheet volatility that really started pushing public companies away from the DB model back in the 90s and 2000s. The contribution is a moving target, but the benefit, from the employee's perspective, is rock solid.
Okay, so let's make that benefit more concrete. How is that guaranteed payment actually figured out for the worker?
There are really two main ways it's done. The most common, especially for, you know, big professional firms and corporations, is the final average pay plan, or FAP. Under this model, your benefit is a percentage of your average earnings over a certain number of years at the very end of your career, say your final 5 years. You take that average salary, you multiply it by your years of service, and then you multiply that by a fixed percentage, like, say, 1.5% or 2%.
Right. So if you worked for 30 years and your average salary in those last 5 years was $100,000 and the factor is 1.5%, you'd get $45,000 a year for life.
Yeah.
30 times 1.5% times 100K.
Exactly. And you can see how that design really incentivizes you to stay with the company for a long time and to climb the ladder, because those last few years have the biggest impact. It really rewards that loyal, long-term employee. A simpler version, which you see a lot in union contracts, is the dollars times service formula. This one is super transparent. You get a set dollar amount per month for every single year you worked.
That sounds much, much easier to get your head around.
It is. If the plan says you get, I don't know, $80 a month for each year of service, a retiree with 40 years knows immediately, okay, I'm getting $3,200 a month. It's a clean, simple promise.
That certainty is definitely the main appeal. But I want to bring in the global context here, because the UK example in our source material shows how regulators can make that promise even stronger by tackling a huge risk. Inflation.
Oh, that's a critical point. In the US, a traditional private DB pension usually isn't required to adjust for inflation after you retire. But in the UK, it's the law. For their registered pension schemes, benefits have to be indexed to inflation, the consumer price index, up to a certain cap, often around 5% a year.
And that's huge. A fixed payment of, say, $4,000 a month sounds great when you're 65. But after 15 years of even just 3% inflation, that payment has lost nearly 40% of its buying power.
It's been eroded. The UK rules basically say, we recognize that living a long time combined with inflation can destroy your retirement security, so we're going to mandate protection against that.
So when it's time to actually get paid, the standard method for a DB plan is an annuity, right? A stream of payments.
That's right. The default payout is almost always a life annuity. The plan guarantees you equal, periodic payments, usually monthly, for the rest of your life. This completely manages the employee's longevity risk. You can't outlive your money. And on top of that, these plans usually have built-in protections for a spouse. For example, a joint distribution where a surviving spouse continues to get a portion of the payment, maybe 50%. That's usually the default option. You have to get your spouse to sign a waiver to choose something else.
What if you don't stay until retirement? Say you leave after 10 years. You're vested. So you've earned that benefit. What happens to it?
You absolutely keep your vested benefit. If you leave early, that benefit essentially becomes frozen or deferred. It just sits in the pension trust until you hit the plan's normal retirement age, and then it starts paying out. There is a small account rule, though. If the plan allows it, and the lump sum value of your benefit is less than $5,000, the plan can just pay you out in a lump sum when you leave. It's an administrative convenience.
Which you would then presumably roll into an IRA or another plan to keep it tax deferred.
Ideally, yes. That's the whole point.
Okay, speaking of limits, the employer has no limit on how much they can contribute. They have to put in whatever the actuary says. But the final benefit that you can receive is actually capped by U.S. law.
Yes. That's a key anti-abuse rule in the Internal Revenue Code. The benefit itself is capped. For 2025, for instance, the maximum annual benefit you can get at retirement age is capped at $275,000. And just as important, the salary used in the formula to calculate that benefit is also capped. For 2025, that's at $345,000.
Wait, hold on. Let me make sure I get that. So if you're a CEO making, say, $1 million a year, and your pension uses that final average pay formula, the plan can't use your $1 million salary in the calculation. It has to pretend you only made $345,000.
Precisely. That compensation limit and the benefit cap work together to ensure the plan is a broad-based retirement vehicle, not just a massive tax shelter for the company's highest earners.
Yeah.
If those executives want a pension based on their full salary, the company has to set up a totally separate, non-qualified plan that doesn't get all the same tax advantages.
Okay, with all this complexity, the unlimited liability for the employer, the strict caps, it's easy to see why companies want it out. But let's talk about the two big inherent flaws that really push them away, starting with the kind of strange way benefits build up.
The first major issue is what's called the age bias in these traditional plans. They have a J-shaped accrual pattern. What that means is the actual value of your promised benefit grows very, very slowly when you're young. The real cost to the employer, the amount of cash they have to pump in, only accelerates dramatically in your mid-career once you've got a lot of years of service and you're getting closer to retirement.
So funding the pension for a 25-year-old is cheap because that money has 40 years to grow. But for a 55-year-old, the employer has to dump in a huge amount of cash right away because there's only 10 years left.
That's exactly. And this cost acceleration, based on age, often made it more expensive to hire or keep older workers. It even led to age discrimination lawsuits. The whole system was built for a world where you stayed at one company your whole life. It really punished people who moved around.
And that ties right into the second big drawback, portability.
Right. DB plans are just not very portable compared to DC plans. If you switch jobs, you often end up leaving behind this small deferred benefit that won't pay out for decades. And even if you can take a lump sum, an actuary has to do this complex calculation to figure out the present day value of that future promise. And the number often feels, well, pretty small to the employee. This lack of portability just made DB plans a bad fit for a modern mobile workforce. They were better for stable institutions, you know, governments, utilities, where people tend to stay put. But really, the single biggest reason for the global shift away from them was just the risk. The open-ended, unpredictable risk of people living longer and markets underperforming was just too much for corporate balance sheets to handle.
Before we move on to DC plans, we have to talk about the hybrid that tried to solve this, the cash balance plan.
Ah, yes, the cash balance plan. It's a perfect example of some clever financial engineering. Legally, it's still a defined benefit plan, so the employer's still on the hook, it's still subject to all the strict funding rules. But, and this is the clever part, the benefit is defined in a way that looks and feels just like a defined contribution account.
So the employee just sees an account balance that goes up every year.
Exactly. The benefit is defined as a stated account balance that gets two types of credits each year. An employer contribution credit, which is usually a percentage of your salary, and a guaranteed interest rate credit. So the employer promises your account will grow by, say, 4% a year, even if the actual fund investments only make 1%, or if they make 10%.
But isn't that guaranteed interest rate just a different way of saying the employer still holds all the investment risk? I mean, does this really change anything for the company, or just how the employee feels about it?
It mostly changes the perception for the employee. It makes the plan way easier to understand. It feels more portable because they see a number, a balance, not some weird formula. But for the employer, you're right. The fundamental risk is still there. They still have to make up the difference if the fund's investments don't hit that guaranteed rate. The cost volatility is still there. It's just hidden behind a structure that looks more stable to the worker. It was a smart evolution designed for a younger workforce, but it's still a DB plan at its core.
All right, now let's cross over into the modern world. Defined contribution plans. If DB was all about the employer managing risk for the group, DC is all about the individual managing their own future.
The whole mechanism is a different species. DC plans, and this includes the 401k and profit sharing plans we all know in the US, are built around one thing.
Mm-hmm.
The individual account. Every single participant gets their own account, and every dollar contributed goes right into that specific account.
And those contributions from your salary from an employer match are then invested in the market, usually with the employee making the choices from a menu of options.
Correct. And the returns on those investments, good or bad, go directly into your individual account. That's the whole structure in a nutshell. The final benefit you get at retirement is based solely on the contributions and whatever investment performance you achieved. The contribution is defined, the outcome is not.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. Because that structure creates this fundamental, massive shift in who is responsible for what.
It is the absolute core of the change in the global retirement contract. In a DC plan, the entire investment risk and also the entire reward is on the shoulders of the individual employee. The employer's duty, for the most part, ends when they make the required contribution and make sure the investment options they offer are prudent. This is a huge transfer of liability from the corporate balance sheet directly to the individual family's budget.
And that risk is not trivial. When you look at the data on the potential downside, it's not just about, you know, maybe having a little less. The numbers show the potential for a complete failure to fund a reasonable retirement.
The data is, frankly, quite sobering. Our source material points to international simulations that show a huge amount of downside risk, and it varies a lot depending on when and where you retire. This isn't just theory, it's measured exposure to failure. I mean, look at the numbers for European DC participants. The simulations show that in countries like France, Italy, and Spain, there's a 10% chance, a 1 in 10 chance of retiring, with a real replacement ratio as low as 0.25, 0.20, or even 0.17.
And for anyone who doesn't live and breathe this stuff, a replacement ratio is the percentage of your pre-retirement income that your retirement savings can replace. A ratio of 0.17 means your retirement income is only 17% of what you were earning. That's a catastrophe.
It's a guaranteed severe drop in your standard of living. It confirms that when the individual bears the full market risk, a very bad outcome is a real, measurable possibility. And on top of that, DC plans bring longevity risk right back to the individual. Most people retire with a lump sum, and then it's up to them to figure out how to make it last for maybe 30 or 40 years. They bear the risk of outliving their savings, a risk that the DB plan's annuity completely solved for them.
Let's talk about the complexity of the U.S. system, which has all these strict and, frankly, confusing limits on contributions. We know the Thrift Savings Plan for federal employees is the biggest DC plan in the world, but for the average person, trying to figure out the contribution caps feels like trying to solve a puzzle.
It really can be. For 2025, the U.S. system has multiple layers of limits. There's an absolute hard ceiling for all money going into tax-advantaged accounts in a single year. That's employer, employee, everything. It's the lesser of $70,000 or 100% of your pay. That's the total deferral limit.
Okay, so 70 grand is the absolute max that can go in, tax-advantaged.
Correct. But then separate from that, there's the limit on what you, the employee, can put in from your own salary into a 401k. That limit is $23,500 for 2025.
But then you get into catch-up contributions, which our sources point out are especially complex, with these weird age-based tiers.
Right. This is where you can really see the legislative sausage-making. Catch-up contributions are for older workers to let them save more as they get closer to retirement. Generally, if you're 50 or older, you can contribute an extra $7,500 on top of that main limit.
But here's the weird part. The sources say that for the specific ages of 60 through 63, the catch-up is even higher. It's $11,250. Why that specific three-year window? What is the logic there?
That is a very recent change, and it's basically a legislative compromise. The idea was to give a final supercharged savings opportunity to workers who are right on the cusp of retirement and maybe fell behind. It's an attempt to let them cram as much as possible into that tax advantage window right at the end. And it's also worth remembering that all these numbers are indexed for inflation, but they only go up in increments of like $500. So the limits can stay flat for a few years until enough inflation builds up to trigger the next jump. It's a way for Congress to keep tight control over the tax revenue impact of these savings plans.
Now, even though I'm the one picking my investments from the plans menu, the employer still has some legal responsibility, some liability, right? They can't just set it up and walk away.
Oh, absolutely not. And this is something a lot of people don't realize. The plan sponsor, the employer, retains a significant fiduciary role. Even though you direct your own investments, the employer is legally responsible for the selection of those investment options and for choosing the plan administrator. They have to make sure the menu of funds is prudent, that it's diverse, and that the fees being charged are reasonable. If they don't, if they, for instance, only offer a bunch of high-cost, poorly performing funds, they can be sued by employees under ERISA, and they often are.
And this whole shift, this move from DB to DC, it's not just a U.S. thing. Looking at how other countries handled it really shows what a global phenomenon this has been.
The transition from DB to DC is the dominant story in private sector retirement all over the world. The UK is probably the clearest case study. The shift there was driven almost entirely by employers who were dealing with rising pension deficits and new accounting rules that forced them to put those massive volatile liabilities right onto their balance sheets. And you can see the result in the numbers. UK employers used to contribute an average of 11% of salary to their old DB plans. Now, for their DC plans, they only contribute an average of 6%.
Wow. That 5% difference is basically the cost of the risk, and that cost has now been pushed entirely onto the employee who has to save that much more out of their own pocket just to get to the same place.
It is a direct transfer of systemic risk, and you see the same story everywhere. Japan brought in DC plans in 2001. Germany, which has really strong labor protections, actually held out until 2017, and even then, the plans could only be created through collective bargaining between unions and employers. It shows how sensitive the issue is.
What about Singapore? Their system seems like the most established, purely DC structure out there.
Singapore's Central Provident Fund, the CPF, is a fascinating national experiment. It's a compulsory, government-mandated DC scheme for the entire country. The government sets high mandatory contribution rates for both the worker and the employer, but the money goes into individual accounts. The final payout is based on those contributions plus some very structured investment returns. It shows how a mandatory DC system can work on a national scale. You also see a similar trend in India, where their national pension scheme, a DC plan, replaced the old DB system for government workers who joined after 2004. The momentum is just undeniable.
When we talk about these huge promises, whether from a company or a country, the most important question is, where is the money coming from? And this brings us to a really crucial distinction, especially for government plans: funded versus unfunded systems.
Right. This shifts the focus from the individual account to the whole macroeconomic structure. A funded plan is what we've been talking about in the private sector. Contributions are set aside in a trust, they're invested, and they are specifically reserved to pay for future benefits. Under ERISA in the US, this is the law for private plans. The money has to be there. An unfunded plan is completely different. It operates on a pay-as-you-go or PY-go basis. There are no significant assets set aside. Instead, the benefits being paid to today's retirees are paid for directly by the contributions and taxes coming in from today's workers.
So current workers are paying for current retirees. It sounds efficient on the surface, but it seems like that system is totally dependent on having a stable or growing population of young workers.
And that dependency is exactly why PAGO is forbidden for private sector plans in the U.S. The risk of collapse if the company or workforce shrinks is just too high. And yet, our sources are clear. PAYGO is the standard operating procedure for almost all public pension systems around the world, in all the OECD countries.
So where does something like U.S. Social Security fit in? It's gigantic, but is it pure PAYGO?
It's technically a hybrid, but its soul is PAYGO. Social Security is a type of defined benefit plan. It's funded by the FICA payroll tax, which goes into the Social Security trust funds. Now, while those trust funds hold trillions in assets, mostly government bonds, the system still relies on current tax revenue to pay for the vast majority of current benefits. It's a massive intergenerational transfer. The trust funds are really more of a buffer for short-term gaps than a fully funded reserve like a private pension.
Which brings us to the elephant in the room. Can a PAYGO system survive when birth rates are falling and people are living longer?
Well, according to the World Bank's analysis of these systems, the answer is a clear no, not without some kind of painful structural change. PAYGO systems create an almost inevitable crisis that's driven by the rising dependency ratio. That's the number of retirees being supported by each active worker. Our sources lay out this grim but predictable life cycle of PAYGO systems in three stages.
Okay, let's walk through these stages because this feels like a ticking time bomb for millions of people around the world.
Stage one is the young stage. This happens right after the system starts. The population is young, it's growing, so you have maybe 15 or more workers paying in for every one person taking money out. The system is flush with cash. This surplus allows governments to be really generous, paying out benefits that are way better than anything you could get on the private market. This was Germany in the 1920s or Brazil in the 1950s. It creates this public perception that the system is a magic money machine.
And those high expectations become politically impossible to walk back later on.
Exactly. Which leads to stage two, the expanding stage. The ratio of workers to pensioners starts to fall, maybe down to 8 or 10 workers per retiree. Governments, still trapped by the promises they made in stage one, start expanding the system to cover more people, but they keep the benefits high. This is when the system starts to build up huge amounts of what's called implicit debt. That's the value of all the future pension promises that have no money set aside to pay for them. This hidden debt can grow to 25% or even 50% of a country's entire GDP, like we saw in Brazil and Turkey in the 90s. The system is broken, but the cash is still flowing, so nobody wants to fix it.
And then finally, the demographic math catches up, and the system hits a wall.
That's stage three, the mature crisis stage. The dependency ratio just craters. You might have 6 or fewer workers for every one pensioner. At this point, that implicit debt is so massive, it threatens to bankrupt the entire country. Governments know they need to either cut benefits or raise taxes dramatically, but they face furious protests from the older generations who paid in their whole lives and demand what they were promised. So what happens? The politicians kick the can down the road. They postpone reforms and start raiding the country's general budget to cover the pension shortfall, with pension costs eating up a double-digit percentage of GDP. We see this playing out across much of Europe right now. It is the inevitable endgame for a pure PAYGO system without painful reform.
Okay, let's bring it back to the U.S. private sector.
Mm-hmm.
For those funded DB plans that do have to set aside assets, there's a critical safety net, the PBGC.
Yes, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. It's basically an insurance company run by the federal government. Most private DB plans have to pay insurance premiums to the PBGC. And in return, the PBGC guarantees a certain portion of your promised pension benefit up to a legal limit if your company goes bankrupt and the pension plan fails. It's there to make sure that workers don't lose everything if their employer goes under. It gets its money from those premiums and from the assets of the failed plans it takes over.
But the PBGC itself holds a staggering amount of liability. I seem to remember a crucial detail that its promises are not explicitly backed by the U.S. government. Why is that distinction so important?
That is the crucial caveat that most people miss. Because it's not explicitly backed by the full faith and credit of the Treasury, the PBGC technically has its own solvency risk. Now, politically, it's almost unthinkable that Congress would let it fail. The public outcry would be immense. But the lack of an explicit guarantee means the agency has to manage its own finances. If several massive pension plans, say from an entire struggling industry, were to all fail at once, it could theoretically drain the PBGC's funds, creating a whole new crisis that the government would have to scramble to solve after the fact.
So even with this insurance, the risk of chronic underfunding is still a huge problem, especially when you compare public plans to private ones.
A huge problem. And chronic underfunding is far worse in state and local government plans. The reason is really about accountability. The private sector was forced to get its house in order by the Pension Protection Act of 2006, the PPA. That law forced private plans to meet much tougher funding targets and to fix shortfalls much more quickly. But public plans are run by politicians, and politicians have a huge incentive to keep contribution rates low to make taxpayers and public unions happy today while pushing the cost of those promises onto future generations. They use less rigorous accounting and just habitually underfund their plans. It's why so many states and cities are in a permanent pension crisis.
The need to stop private companies from doing that, from mismanaging funds or just walking away from their promises, is exactly why the U.S. created this massive, incredibly complex legal framework called ERISA in 1974.
ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, is the Bible of U.S. retirement law. It came about after a series of high-profile pension failures in the 60s. It's built on old principles of trust law, and it basically created a whole system of federal rules that override state laws for private sector plans.
And the absolute heart of that whole system is the legal standard that managers of the money have to meet, the fiduciary standards.
The standard is incredibly high. Anyone who has discretionary control over plan assets is legally a fiduciary. And under ERISA, these fiduciaries must manage the money prudently, and this is the key phrase, in the exclusive interest of the participants and beneficiaries. Not for the company's benefit, not for the shareholders, but exclusively for the workers and retirees. And that standard has real teeth. If you violate it, you can be held personally liable for any losses the plan suffers. The threat of personal financial ruin is a very powerful motivator to act responsibly.
That's a serious protection. But ERISA and the tax code also have rules to stop the system from just becoming a tax dodge for the wealthy, right?
Right, through a whole battery of anti-abuse rules. The non-discrimination rules are designed to make sure a plan covers a broad swath of employees, not just the executives. And it ensures that the benefits don't disproportionately favor what the law calls highly compensated employees, or HCEs. Plans have to run a bunch of complicated tests every single year to prove they're in compliance.
So what happens if a plan fails one of those tests? What's the real-world consequence?
If it fails, meaning the plan is too generous to the HCEs compared to everyone else, there are a couple ways to fix it. The HCEs might have to get some of their contributions back as taxable cash, or the employer might have to make extra contributions to the non-HCEs to balance things out. The law basically forces the employer to spread the benefits around if they want to keep the huge tax advantages of having a qualified plan. There's also a related rule called the top-heavy rule. If a plan is found to be top-heavy, meaning most of the benefits are going to a small group of owners or key executives, the law requires the plan to provide a minimum baseline benefit to all the other employees. It's another way to guarantee the rank and file get something if the plan is skewed towards the top.
So the company's desire to save on taxes is forced to align with the public policy goal of broad retirement coverage. Now, one of the most powerful protections, and one that's hugely important for anyone facing financial trouble, is the one that shields these assets from creditors.
This is the anti-assignment and anti-garnishment rule, and it is a cornerstone of ERISA. It means your pension benefits and the money in your qualified accounts are protected from your general creditors. You can't sign your benefit over to pay a debt, and it can't be garnished to pay off most personal debts. It's a deliberate policy choice to put retirement savings in a protected class.
But there are a few exceptions, right? Especially when it comes to family court.
Yes. Very limited, very specific exceptions. The main one is for divorce, alimony, or child support. But even then, it's not automatic. The court order has to meet a whole list of specific requirements to be considered a qualified domestic relations order, or a QDRO. The QDRO is essential. Without it, the plan can't pay out. It basically reclassifies a portion of your pension as belonging to your former spouse, allowing it to be paid out without violating ERISA's anti-assignment rule. It's a high legal bar to clear.
Finally, let's just quickly circle back to the solvency rules that ERISA uses to make sure DB promises are actually kept, especially since they were toughened up by the Pension Protection Act in 2006.
The PPA made the minimum funding standards much, much stricter. Before PPA, employers had a lot of leeway. The new law forced private DB plans to target a 100% funded status much more quickly, using very conservative actuarial assumptions. If you fail to meet these standards now, you get hit with escalating penalty taxes and you're forced to make corrective contributions immediately. It took away most of the wiggle room. And we should also mention the distribution rules for spousal protection. ERISA says the default payout from a pension must be a joint and survivor annuity. That means if the retired worker dies, their spouse is guaranteed to receive a survivor benefit, usually 50% for the rest of their life. If you want to take your pension in any other form, you have to get your spouse's written notarized consent. It's a powerful protection for surviving partners.
So this whole regulatory machine, from fiduciary duties to funding rules, it's this dense web of checks and balances, all designed to make sure that when a private company makes a long-term promise, it's forced to keep it. So this deep dive has really laid out two completely different philosophies. The choice between defined benefit and defined contribution is, it's the difference between relying on a promise from an organization and relying on your own financial skill and market luck.
The essential takeaway for you, the listener, is really about who holds the risk. In the DB world, the actuary takes the calculated risk for the employer who manages this big pool of money. In the DC world, you become your own actuary. You have to manage the investment risk, you have to manage the risk of living too long, and you bear the full cost if things go wrong.
Let's just quickly recap those two biggest trade-offs we talked about. You are trading a known benefit under a DB plan for a known contribution in a DC plan. And you're trading employer risk, where the company is on the hook for individual risk, where you and your family are on the hook.
And we've seen that the global shift has been overwhelmingly toward that individual risk model. It's moved all that complexity and volatility off corporate balance sheets and onto the individual saver, even as the data suggests that many people in DC plans might end up with retirement incomes that are just deeply inadequate.
And that brings us to our final provocative thought. Our discussion of PA WIGO systems showed that even the big government-run pension systems, the ones millions of people see as their ultimate safety net, are facing an existential threat from demographics. That inevitable stage three crisis, when the ratio of workers to retirees falls off a cliff.
So given that the global trend is to shift all this risk to you, the individual, through DC plans, and knowing that the public safety nets are themselves facing demographic headwinds that are forcing painful political choices, how prepared should you be to manage all of this risk on your own? In today's world, just relying on historical government promises might not be enough. It makes it critical for you to actually look into the funding status, demographic trends, and the dependency ratio of any public system you're counting on, because that political promise you think is solid might just be backed by a mathematical certainty of future fiscal pain.